Thank you very much. I want to just start with this quotation from Justin. He's a prisoner serving a very long life sentence, and he says, "Prison's like a standstill in your life, isn't it? I'm being taken out of the world yet and put in here, and this is its own little world. It's like you've been stuck in time, but everyone else is still moving." Dominique Moran has argued that geographers have tended to view incarceration mainly in relation to space, while prison sociologists have more often focused on the temporal dimensions of imprisonment, including the sort of subjective experience of time. Justin's comment, I think, alerts us to the ways that time and space are, and this is something that Dominique points out, mutually constituted. And so what I want to do today is discuss these issues in relation to prisoners serving very long sentences. So I'm drawing on a study that I've been conducting over the last few years with Susie Hulley and Serena Wright. You can see our three main research questions here, which are to do with the problems that these prisoners experience, their social adaptations, and also how they feel about the legitimacy of their predicament. And the research has involved long interviews with 125 men and 21 women, all serving life sentences with tariffs, so minimum sentences of 15 years or more, and all sentenced to an age 25 or under. And we've also collected more than 300 surveys, but I'm mainly going to draw on the interview data today. And our overall analytic framework regards long-term imprisonment as a sort of triple dislocation, so a sort of socio-spatial dislocation from the prisoner's life world prior to being imprisoned, so a sort of separation from their social ties and relationships. Secondly, an existential dislocation. That's to do with the prisoner having to come to terms with the fact that they've committed a murder, or they're seen to have committed a murder. And then third, a dislocation from the prisoner's imagined future. And that's of particular significance given that most of our interviewees were sentenced when they were in their late teens or early 20s, so before they felt that they'd really established a life for themselves. So really this dislocation is from kind of where I was, who I am, and what my life was going to be. And when our participants described what it was like to be given such a large sentence at an early age, those that were early on in the sentence conveyed a sense of what we're calling temporal vertigo, a sort of dizziness about what lay ahead of them. So one prisoner said to me he saw his life, he saw his future flashing before his eyes when he was sentenced. And the thing I just want to emphasise from these quotes is the kind of this sense of shock. So Curtis says, "I was 19 when I got sentenced. Basically, all them years I've just done growing up, I've got to do them again in prison, and it's like, whoa." And we get this same phrase, "whoa," from Yvette, who describes the fact that her little girl would be 30 by the time she was released. She says, "I was 19 when I got my tariff. You have given me a tariff that was longer than I'd been alive." And I think between them, these quotes indicate two key themes. The first was the sheer difficulty of conceptualizing, understanding the amount of time that they were set to be imprisoned. So Martin here says he had no concept of 18 years of life. And as we see in the third and fourth quotations here, the best way that prisoners had of trying to make sense of or make meaningful the number of years that they would serve was either thinking about their own existence so far, so the sense that, you know, you've sentenced me to more years than I've actually been conscious of existence, or thinking about children who had just been born but who would be the same age that they were now by the time they were released. And the second theme is captured in Curtis's comment that think that it would just mess up my head to think about his sentence lengths. And this was a very common kind of statement, that to think of the years before release, the number of years one had to serve, was psychologically overwhelming. So we get some sense in these quotes of that kind of theme, that thinking beyond the immediate present was a threat to psychological health. So Alfie says, "It's just going to mess my head up." And so what we get very, very consistently among early stage lifers is the sense of living day-to-day, a kind of myopic existence, an ability only to focus on the on what was very immediate in a kind of endless, repetitive present, rather than making any plans in the future, or plans as to how they would serve their sentence. So in the last quote here, Zuber says, "The future is just not something you think about. Today's the day. If you survive it, that's another day tomorrow." And that orientation, I think, represents a form of denial. And early stage prisoners engaged in various forms of denial, denial of time, as a way of coping with their predicament. So one was to stop paying attention to time. So lots of prisoners talked about not foregoing having a watch, or not looking at calendars. So people laughed when we asked if they ticked off the days on their calendars, because calendars are a marker of the amount of time that lies ahead of you. And so what Antoine describes here is trying to lose track of time. The second form of denial was more literal, so it involved appealing against the sentence or the conviction. And that helped time pass quickly, as Sim notes here, because it provided focus and activity. But it also allowed prisoners to persuade themselves that they that in the end they wouldn't have to serve the amount of time that they'd been given. So to quote Dan here in the final quote, "I don't think about the future in prison, because for me I have no intention of spending that long in jail. My focus isn't prison, it's the world beyond prison, and mentally I make an effort to transcend my existence here." So appealing helped prisoners place themselves out of the institution. So it relocated them in space and also help them transcend time, and that helped negate this fear of the future. A second strategy, maybe another, a sort of subset of denial, was to compress time by distinctive forms of reasoning. So Hashim here argues that the sentence in effect only amounts to 2 years once you factor out the time he'll spend sleeping and eating and engaging in enjoyable activities. And lots of other prisoners, like Harris, sort of truncated their sentence length by saying, actually, I'll consider myself free at the point at which I'm in an open prison, rather than the actual point of release. And others engaged in a slightly different form of denial, where they would describe feeling undaunted by the number of years ahead of them. So this quote, this third quote from Terence, I think is interesting, because he's kind of blithely optimistic about the amount of time that lies ahead of him, talking as though it's really not that long, but actually describing way over 20 years before he gets into an open prison. And this was quite common, this sort of making time relative. So prisoners would often say, once I get into single figures in terms of the number of years of my sentence, that's the home straight. And then a third strategy, which I won't dwell on, is suppression of time, mainly through the use of drugs or drink. But this is about suppressing consciousness both of time and place, and also through sleeping away your sentence. So common to all of these strategies was a sort of limited sense of control. We're drawing in our analysis on the work of Margaret Archer, a social theorist, who talks about this idea of fractured reflexivity. And that applies nicely to our early stage prisoners who were traumatized by their situation to the degree that they could only focus on their immediate needs of survival and were unable to exercise full governance of their own lives. So it's interesting to me that Archer uses the same language that lots of our prisoners used about being adrift, taking each day as it comes. And in quotes like this, we get this very clear sense of prisoners living each day as it comes, because of a sense that anything could happen, that they had no control over what might happen to them. And this is kind of ironic, because when prisoners described the present, what they described was life being completely predictable, uneventful. So early stage prisoners described time in terms of repetition, routine, monotony, and so on. So time in the present dragged, and yet if we highlight different bits of these slides, what we see here is a description that when they looked back on the amount of time they'd already served, time seemed to have moved very quickly. And this is something that Ian O'Donnell, in his excellent book Prisoners, Solitude and Time, explains as the result of unchanging routine. So in such circumstances, when viewed retrospectively, because time is flat, because it's devoid of significant events, it collapses into a kind of homogeneous unit, and that gives the impression of speed. So there's no episodic memory as such, so that, to draw on these two quotes, time blends into one, or to quote Bernard, because of the monotony, the similarity of every day, it's very hard to sort of pinpoint a particular date. And I think that's very different from the sense of life being life moving quickly because it's absorbing, eventful, textured, and so on. Returning to the present, what emerges quite starkly from the empirical material is the recurrence of metaphors of death and killing. So I've included lots of examples here just to reinforce how consistent this sort of discourse was. And it applied both to the need to kill time, but also the fear and the feeling of being killed slowly by time. And this theme of death is relevant to the way that I want to conceptualise the prison for this group of prisoners as a kind of non-place. So again, this is specific to the early stage lifers who felt that the prison sat outside real life. It was somewhere where one's experience was like that of a zombie. Not quite in the way that the term is normally used to imply people that have died but being reanimated, but the opposite of that. So being alive but feeling yourself to be dead, or feeling yourself to be non-living. And so this term, non-place, may be familiar to you. It's used by the French anthropologist Marc Auger, and he describes non-places as locations like supermarkets, airports, motorways, places of transience where we go en route to somewhere else, somewhere more significant. And they're places where we have no real sense of investment, of identity, of the need to make social relationships. We are just passengers or customers or guests when we're within them. So they're devoid of significance. They're not real places. So to return to these quotes, they are places where we just want time to pass and where real existence is suspended. The prisoners used terminology that was very suggestive of such ideas. So they talked about being frozen, being in a time capsule, in hibernation, while real life continued outside. And that's quite common to the literature in the sociology of imprisonment, but particularly powerful with this group who are serving decades of their lives in prison, and initially at least considering that time to be non-time, unreal, and so on. But prisoners couldn't sustain that position. So as these quotes indicate, coming to terms with the sentence meant acknowledging that the prison was now home, and it was the only place where they could meaningfully live their life. So in the first quote, Carl says, "It doesn't matter where you're living, you're still living a life." And in this second quote, the prisoner reflects, "This is home now, this is life now." And almost all of our participants who were further into their sentences said that after a few years, the reality set in, and I'm quoting Edward Zamble here, that they were persons living in prison rather than offenders doing time. So instead of denying and compressing time, they'd found ways to actively engage with time, to make it productive. So they tamed their anxieties about the future by splitting the period into segments and giving themselves time anchors in the future. They also found ways of transcending time. So in this first quote here from Carl, this is a description really of lifting himself both out of time and place through the activity of reading. And certainly these prisoners were much more likely than the early stage lifers to describe time as something that they could use rather than something that they needed to kill. And so, moreover, these prisoners who were further into their sentences, like Victor, consistently described themselves as having matured, become more emotionally controlled, more respectful of others, and more psychologically stable. Most of them had engaged in a kind of profound existential reflection about what it meant to take someone else's life and to have your own life taken away from you through a long sentence. So, in other words, as they progressed through the sentence, their identities were reanimated. But the second half of the quote is significant too, because they were all too aware that in the absence of social markers, milestones, rites of passage, their maturation was limited and contextual. So existence was schizophrenic, inside and outside simultaneously, to use Antone's term here, that on separate tracks until they were released, at which point we suspect that this permanent loss of time that they experience makes its presence felt more clearly. So I guess I want to finish just by saying the prison boundary, I think, functions here not just in terms of space, but also time and identity, separating life into two domains whose terms and meanings themselves shift over the course of the sentence. Thank you.